Hello, friends. It is I, Duncan Trussell, and you are listening to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast, and this is the 108th episode of this podcast. And the number 108 is a transcendent number. 8 plus 1 is 9. 9 represents 3 threes. 3 represents the Trinity. Father, Son, Holy Ghost, Brahman, Vishnu, Shiva, the thesis, the antithesis, and the synthesis. Mother, Father, Child. It goes on and on and on. The triangle. The connections in the Sri Yantra Mandala. The golden mean. It represents so many things, many of which I don't understand at all, including the Rasa Leela. Rasa means juice, and Leela means dance. And the Rasa Leela refers to, in Vaishnava mythology, this sacred night where Krishna, in the forests of Vrindavan, was so overcome by the beauty of nature that he began to play his flute. And this mystical sound of God playing his flute out in the forest caused all the gopi girls to leave whatever it was they were doing to go dance with Krishna. And Krishna split himself up into 108 parts so that he could individually make love with each of those sweet cowherd gals. And that's a very deep thing. On the surface, it sounds like it already is pretty deep. It sounds like a psychedelic space orgy. But the thing that it's pointing to, at least in my mind, is the idea that you can have a direct communication with nature, the supreme intelligence, or if you want to be lazy, God. And that's a beautiful story. There's 108 beads on many malas that people chant on, including the malas that the Hare Krishnas chant on. There's actually 109 beads. But the 109th bead, which is sort of at the center of the mala, is, depending on what religion you're in, is either the Guru bead or the Krishna bead. And it's the bead that when you reach that bead, you stop chanting and think of your guru or of God and then go in the opposite direction. And that represents the cycles of time, the seasons, and so many other incredible things. You could just get lost in it. You can get lost in symbols because they're so powerful and beautiful and so liberating if you use them in the right way. But the weird thing about symbols is they can also imprison you. That's what's fascinating, is that symbols can simultaneously be a lock and a key. For example, take the word love. The word love is a symbol that points in the direction of this incredible feeling of pure novelty and freedom and autonomy. It's that feeling that happens when you realize that you are in a brand new universe. It's being born again. When you're falling in love and you start feeling that first sweet fluttering of the heart, and you look around and this boring old dumb world that you were shuffling through is suddenly glowing with light, and you notice butterflies and flowers and things you never noticed before. You notice how gigantic the sky is, and suddenly you start hearing birds again. And every time you hear the birds, you think of whoever you're falling in love with. There's every stupid love song on the radio that you've heard a million times through the course of whatever dark depression or whatever empty, boring, lonely moments preceded you meeting your sweet, darling lover. Suddenly those songs that were so stale and boring and embarrassing are filled with meaning. You can listen to the cheesiest love song ever. You can listen to Beyonce singing her newest hit, Drunken in Love, or whatever that song is. And if you listen to that and you're not in love, it's very similar to listening to house music when you haven't taken a dose of LSD or ecstasy. It's just like, ugh, God, this sounds like Pac-Man vomiting. I don't want to listen to this. Get me out of here. Why do they have glow sticks? Why are they rubbing Vicks Vapor Rub on their neck? I don't understand any of it. But if you take ecstasy, somehow it suddenly all makes sense. Suddenly the glow sticks make sense. Suddenly you understand why all the various components that are happening at whatever rave you're at are there. And you understand. Well, that's what love is like. Love is the ecstasy that makes the music of this reality sound beautiful. And the Rasa Leela is about music. It's the flute. It's the sound of Krishna's flute. And to me, that sound is what comes through the teachings of Ram Dass or Jack Kornfield or any of the crazy teachers who are always drawing you out of the musty old hut composed of boring symbols that you've gotten stuck inside of. And we all get stuck inside those musty, boring huts. They're the people who are always luring you out. And that's what the Rasalila is about, I guess. It's about listening for the sound of Krishna's flute, or listening for the sound that is underneath everything, that's always inviting you to climb out of the old stagnant symbol structures that you've gotten trapped inside of. I just had definitely the greatest birthday of my life, and was driving back from this vineyard that I was hanging out at with my girlfriend, and we're on the 101, and it is a wonderful day. We've just had some delicious wine. The day before was Bicycle Day, which, as many of you know, is the celebration of the first intentional ingestion of LSD by a human being on planet Earth. It was an incredible day. And so we're listening to Jack Kornfield, who's this Buddhist teacher that I really like. And he's been on this podcast, actually. We're listening to him, one of his Audible audiobooks, and it's great. And I'm really connecting with a lot of what he's saying. And the 101, even though it's slammed with traffic, it doesn't seem bad to me, because that's how great my day is, that the 101 doesn't even seem bad, even though it's just congested with traffic. All the cars look beautiful. Everything looks incredible. We're listening to Jack Kornfield, and my girlfriend suggests that we go swimming in the ocean that we're driving next to. Now, the first thought that I have when she says this is, no, I'm listening to someone talk about Buddhism right now. I don't want to swim in the cold-ass ocean. And then I realize, oh, God, I'm basically inside a Jack Kornfield story right now. Because rather than go and experience life, rather than go and dive into the ocean of experience, I would rather listen to someone inviting you to go dive into the ocean of experience. And that's the thing. You can get caught up. All these teachers, they're telling you, stop the car and jump in the ocean. They're all asking you, turn off the radio. You don't have to keep listening to us. Dive into the ocean of love. Jump out of your comfort zone and into this ocean of love that's around you at all times. All you've got to do is abandon those crusty, stinky symbols that you've gotten stuck in. Just like some smelly old sock you've been wearing for a few days. Pull off the sock and jump in the ocean. And so that's what we did. We pulled over. We found a nearly empty beach. And I went diving into the cold water with my 40-year-old body. And I felt like I was kissing God on the mouth. It was amazing. I had done something I normally never would have done. And I think I'm not going to keep saying this, but that's what the Rasalila is about. It's about not just hearing the flute, but following in the direction of where the flute is coming from. Abandon the old systems. Out with the old, in with the new. That's what Easter's about. Happy Easter, all of you. Happy Resurrection Day. I hope that you guys find a way over the next few weeks to be rejuvenated and reborn, and can shake off whatever stupid, stinky, crusty symbols are holding you into the smelly hut of your life, when just right down this tiny little path is a blue-skinned cowherd boy who wants to make sweet love with you all night long. This is a great podcast. Raghu Marcus is joining us today. But first, some quick business. I'm going to read a news story to you. If there's kids in the room, I suggest that you have them leave. This is a very sad and tragic story. Shortly after midnight, around the time that he left his work, George Winston entered the basement apartment of 18-year-old Karen Sparks. He had been designing a website for her, and she had paid him way too much money, and he was coming to collect the bill. But something happened. Something broke inside of his brain, and he bludgeoned the sleeping woman with a metal rod from her bed frame, smashing her with a computer that he had used to design her blog, and then left with her face in his pocket, leaving behind a faceless corpse to be found by the police. He had painted HTML all over the wall of her apartment. The HTML was code for a poorly designed website. The website itself was a website with a malformed URLs and a shopping cart that did not work. The death of Anne-Marie Winston Williams is a death that did not have to happen. If Anne-Marie Winston Williams had only gone to Squarespace.com instead of hiring a web designer off of Craigslist. Today, in the United States, just under heart attacks, the second leading cause of death is being bludgeoned to death by a dissatisfied web designer who has not been paid the inordinate amount of money that he demanded to create the website he was not equipped to build because he was not a good web designer. Don't let this happen to you guys. I don't mean to bring Nancy Grace level darkness into this podcast, but I feel like I should warn you. There is a darkness at the edge of town, and that darkness weighs 290 pounds, has pizza all over his shirt, and cannot design another website without plunging his fingers into your eyeballs and ripping out your eyeballs and filling your eye sockets with keyboard cleaner. That's how you do. Is that how you want to die? Is that how you want to die? You want your last moments to be you waking up to the slobbering sound of a web designer climbing through your window, his breathlessness because he had to go up a flight of steps, the strange stink emanating from his unwashed underarms, the smell combining with the Dr. Pepper burps coming out of his mouth as he plods towards your bed to bludgeon you to death with the very keyboard he used to create your flower delivery website that never even worked? That can happen. Go to squarespace.com if you're thinking about getting a website built and you don't want to risk being murdered. Now, I'm not saying there's not great web designers out there. I know there are great web designers out there. I use one. His name's Stee. He's amazing. I'm so lucky to have found him. It's like finding a unicorn in a forest filled with rapists. Yes, I said it. It's true. Finding a great web designer is like finding a unicorn in San Quentin. It's hard. You're lucky if you find a great web designer. If you find one, congratulations. You have contacted the Messiah. To all you great web designers out there, I bow to you. But you know as well as I do that there are an ocean of overpriced hacks who would willingly take the money of people who only want to start a brand new business because they finally had the courage to get their life going. And in return for that money, they will give them a crappy, shoddy, useless product. A lot of people can't afford a high-level web designer. The truth of the matter is that really great web designers aren't cheap. They're expensive. And if you want to, if you can't afford a web designer in the old days, if you couldn't afford a web designer, that's it. You either spend the next 6 months snorting Adderall and learning how to code HTML, or you start a brick and mortar store. But these days, you can start your own website. You can create a high level, aesthetically pleasing, functional website for as low as $9 a month by going to squarespace.com. They've got a modular system that will allow you to put whatever pieces together that you need to put together to create a really great website. I've gone there. We've built a website using Squarespace. You can go to podrift.com. That is the website for the Oculus Rift podcast project that I'm working on. That's a pretty good website, but if you want to see a really great website designed using Squarespace, go to Squarespace. Squarespace.com was designed using Squarespace. Figure that one out. I can't. It seems like someone must have a time machine or something. I don't know how exactly that would have worked, but it worked. They built Squarespace using Squarespace. The thing invented itself. It's like trying to figure out the Big Bang. We don't know how Squarespace came into existence. All we know is that it's there and it's there for you. So if you've been creating excuses for not starting that business or blog or whatever type of website you want to start, if you've been creating excuses that are based on not being able to find a web designer, not having the skills to do it, not having the money to do it, all those excuses are now gone. If you go to squarespace.com, you can start building a professional level, badass website for as low as $8 a month. That's 20 pages, galleries, 500 gigabytes bandwidth, 2 gigabytes storage, 2 contributors, fully integrated e-commerce, and you can accept donations and sell one product. They've got other tiers too. Professional, $16 a month, and business, $24 a month. If you sign up for an entire year with any of these, you get a free domain name. So go to squarespace.com if you've been thinking about starting a website. Everything is there for you, and they have great support. I made sure of this by contacting them. They get back to you right away, and that's an important thing when you're building a website. No matter how simple the system is, you always need help for this stuff, and Squarespace is there to help you. So go to squarespace.com, sign up, put my name in, and you will get 10% off. That's Duncan. When you sign up, put my name in as your code word, you will get 10% off. Trust me, guys, the last thing you want to have happen to you is to be dragged out of your house by a slobbering, maniacal, disgruntled, hacky web designer, taken to his awful house, dragged into the basement, and then have HTML carved into your back for the next 2 years as Nancy Grace talks about how you vanished, leaving behind only a shitty blog with a shopping cart that didn't work. You don't want that to happen. You don't want to join the legions of murdered. Do you know how many people disappear a day in the United States? A lot. And that number equals the number of shitty websites that are created a day. You do the math. Go to squarespace.com. Start a great website today. Put my name in. Duncan, 10% off. We're also brought to you by Amazon.com. We have an Amazon portal located at duncantrussell.com. The next time you're going to buy anything online, whatever plastic you need, you can get it at Amazon. Go through our portal. Go to duncantrussell.com. Just remember, go through our portal. It costs you nothing extra, and Amazon gives us a very small percentage of anything that you buy. So it's an excellent way for you to support this podcast. Please do it. Just bookmark the portal. You only have to do it once, and then anytime you go to Amazon, you could be sending sweet green energy into the coffers of the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. We also have a shop located at duncantrussell.com. Here you will find t-shirts, posters, and stickers that you can wear. Each of these are sigils designed to draw into your life high-potency level chaos magic that will inject novelty into your life. So buy a damn t-shirt, would you? We've got a new design. I'm creating a new design right now. Ron Rigi's going to design my new t-shirt, so I'm really excited about that. That is coming. Finally, May 24th, not 27th, which I've been saying, God damn it, in earlier podcasts. May 24th, we will be doing a live Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast, and I don't know who all the guests are going to be, but I do know that Emil Amos from the Holy Sons is going to be there, and he's going to play some music up front and be one of the guests. And there's going to be lots more happening than that. If you go to duncantrussell.com, there is a ticket link there. I highly recommend getting tickets because this thing is definitely going to sell out. So get tickets now. Don't put it off. Buy tickets now. Go to duncantrussell.com. The link is there in the forum. And I've got a tour coming up, which is going to be happening in August. I'm going to be traveling all over the South. I'm going to be in Asheville, Durham, a few other places. That's going to be up on the website soon. Okay, let's get this podcast going. Today's guest is one of the hosts of the Mind Rolling podcast. He hosts that along with the great David Silver. You can go to mindrollingpodcast.com. They've got incredible episodes. The most recent one is with Krishna Das, who is this incredible kirtanwala who plays beautiful music. And I got to listen to him the last time I was at a Ram Das retreat because he played every night. But there's 64 episodes of this thing up now, and they're life changers. All of them are incredible. He's also the director of the Love Serve Remember Foundation, and that's Ram Das's foundation. And he got to hang out with Maharaji, Neem Karoli Baba, in India a few decades ago. So that's an incredible thing by itself. I'm really lucky to have him as a friend and a teacher, and would really appreciate it if you guys would check out the Mind Rolling Podcast, because it's amazing. It's a really, really good podcast, and now there's 64 episodes of it. All right, open your third eyes, spread out your arms, climb out of that stinky hut, and let's go make out with Krishna and Raghu Marcus. Or at least have a picnic. We don't have to make out.
One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten.
One, two, three, four, five. Hold on one sec. Raghu Marcus, thank you so much for taking the time.
You are quite welcome. I'm always glad to be here.
But it's especially precious that you're giving me an hour of your time when you're in Hawaii at the spring retreat. I don't know. I keep thinking to myself, why didn't I come this year? I should have come. And you've been calling me, and you start off every conversation by describing in detail the smell of the flowers, the wind blowing through Lumeria, which is this incredibly beautiful, I don't know, what would you call that? A spiritual center? What is that place?
It's just a retreat center. It's just, it's done by an artist from Los Angeles, somebody who, he wrote a book called Sacred Spaces, actually, and Zorn is his name, and it is impeccably done. Inside, outside, plan, layout, the kind of foliage and plants and trees, and it's on a hillside overlooking the ocean. It's just a sacred spot. It's really amazing.
God,
how are you doing anyhow? Poor thing, you're in L.A.
Well, yeah, it's not like I'm in hell or anything like that. It's not like I'm in.
You know what? You could be in Montreal, where I'm from, because on Tuesday they're supposed to get something like 2 feet of snow.
Oh.
Okay.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, you're right. I shouldn't.
That is good. I'm here.
But I remember that feeling when you get off the plane in Hawaii is unlike anything. When you feel the energy coming out of the ground there, there's some extra prana or some extra juice coming out of that place. And then you combine it with those retreats and it's just, it's unforgettable. I don't know. I feel really, anyway, I'm not going to keep saying I feel dumb for not going there, but how's it going? What's the theme of the retreat this time?
So the theme of the retreat is from Sharon Salzberg. Her idea was to call it compassion and adversity. Since we all have adversity and we certainly need to cultivate compassion to get through that, that seemed right. So, we're right in the middle of all that. And in the last set, and we have Jai Utal here as well. Do you know Jai?
Yes. Well, I mean, I know the music.
Yeah. Well, he, by the way, he has a new record out, and you should tell your listeners about it. It's called Return to Shiva Station.
Oh,
Jai
cool.
Utal, Uttal. And it is an acoustic reinvention of an album he did. Actually for my label at the time, Triloka, in like 15 years ago or something or more. So it is a momentous moment, sort of, to kind of go full circle with him. He is a student of Ali Akbar Khan, one of the greatest musicians in the world. So if you want to hear something really solid and totally, absolutely connect you to the real spirit, I mean, he's got real spirit. And so Jai Utal, and go to Duncan's Amazon portal and buy it through there, right?
Yeah, please.
Or go to mindrollingpodcast.com and buy it. Go there. Okay, that's the ad for the day.
Okay, great. What's
wait a minute.
Go ahead.
I just got to read this thing to you, okay?
Okay.
It's about compassion. You think people would be interested? It's not too long.
Yeah, let's hear it. I want to hear it.
Yeah, okay. And then I'll tell you all about the retreat.
Perfect.
Compassion involves more than simply knowing about a different situation. Even witnessing pain directly does not necessarily prompt a reaction of compassion. And I'll tell you who's writing this after I read it. I observed this for myself once while watching a dock in which animals were being hung upside down to be slaughtered. As their throats were cut, blood spurted out and their legs jerked in terror and pain. It was extremely hard to watch. Unbearable, really. But as the butchers sawed through the animals' necks to deprive them of life, the men were laughing and joking. They could obviously see the animals' painful movements and hear their cries. The suffering was visible and audible, but they did not seem to recognize that these were signs of terrible pain. And even if the butchers did see that they were inflicting pain, the animal's suffering didn't amount to anything for them. They treated it as if they were watching a show. In fact, some people even kill animals as a form of recreation. Hunting is considered a sport in some cultures, isn't it? Some people seem to believe it is courageous to kill animals. Unfortunately, nowadays we have developed the wrong kind of fearlessness. Fearlessness in harming others. At some point, this courage, quote-unquote, in harming others is bound to turn on us. As people become habituated to taking the life of animals with no thought for the pain they are causing, in the end it becomes easy to harm and kill humans. Even the pain of our fellow human beings can cease to catch our attention. The real courage that comes from compassion is very far from this. When compassion is present, we do not overlook others' pain. Rather, there is a sense of urgency to end that pain as if a fire had just been lit underneath you. When you have such compassion, as soon as you see suffering, you wish to jump up and act to end it at once. You have no fear and no hesitation in taking on the suffering of other people, animals, and even the planet itself. This is what I would call the right kind of fearlessness. Hmm. This is the fearlessness of true heroes.
Hmm.
Can you take a wild guess as to who would write such a thing?
I'm going to say George W. Bush. Is that from his, his autobiography?
Huh?
Is that the autobiography of George W. Bush? Or is that it's Rumsfeld, isn't it?
Yeah. This is written by the 17th Karmapa, so you better take that all back.
I take it back.
this is like the
who's the 17th Karmapa? Can you say what does Karmapa mean?
Third in line, they say. Not in line, that's not the proper thing. The third most important lama in Tibet. Number one is the Dalai Lama. Number two is the Panchen Lama, who was kidnapped by the Chinese, okay, and is being held in prison in China. And number three is Karmapa. And this Karmapa is about 30 years old. And his predecessor, so many of us have met both the 16th and the 17th Westerners. The 16th is exactly the same like Nimkaroli Baba, a fully omniscient being.
And so I met him, and then I met the 17th, who's this 30-year-old young guy. And when I met him, you hear all this bullshit about, oh, yeah, tulkus, and, you know, they transfer something, gets transferred to their body, reincarnated, the kid finds the right objects when they're presented to him that were the objects of his predecessor. People, oracles have dreams. I mean, it's the whole nine yards. But you just read this shit, you know, you don't, it's just head stuff until you actually meet this guy. Which I did, the 17th Karmapa, in a hotel room in Washington when the Dalai Lama was there. This is a couple of years ago, and he at the end, and we just bantered around in his hotel room about worldly stuff. There was nothing, you know. We were having fun. He's a young, you know, he's amazing, and he's absolutely a beautiful young man. Inside and out. Anyhow, he put this, you know, they put it's called a kata, scarf around you as an honor at the end.
Yes.
And he said goodbye and he clasped my hands. For 2 hours, I understood the whole succession, the reincarnation. Holy shit, this is real. You know, it was experiential. This is real what these people do.
That's a shocking moment, isn't it? When you realize that it's real. I can remember when I started realizing that was from hanging out with you guys. And that's a really intense moment when
it's a transporting moment for sure.
It really is, because it's so funny how the mind, when you hear these stories, every single story that you hear, my mind tends to reduce it to Western, to the way the West likes to dilute stuff. You know, for example, the West loves to call, you know, healing the placebo effect. And when you hear, well, the placebo effect, and then right away you think, well, that means it's not real. There's a great article I just read, actually, about the placebo effect in this case where a man came to the hospital with all these tumors and they told him that he was going to die. And he had heard that there was some sort of weird serum made from horse blood. It was some strange thing. And he demanded that he got to be injected with this stuff. And the doctor, realizing this man only had maybe a month to live, thought, why not? Let's inject him with it. If he wants it, it won't hurt him. And so he injected the man with this stuff. And they say, this is a medical report, I'll find the article and put a link on my website. But the tumors, they say, melted away. Over the course of a couple of days, the tumors just melted away. And then he read that this horse serum, he finally found something that shows that this was actually bullshit and didn't work at all, and the tumors came back. So this is one of the many cases of people, you know, that shows how very powerful this stuff is. And anyway, I think I've gotten a little bit off track because I want to talk to you more about compassion, which is...
Well, wait a minute. What about this incredible article he wrote? I mean, he's not like writing about the teachings of the Bardos. He's writing about like what's right in front of us and what's going on in this planet right now. And, you know, this doc obviously set him off. And he wrote this thing. I found it because of this whole thing being about compassion. And, you know, he really spells it out here. I mean, you know, it's like, we do so many things that are screwed up.
Do you consider eating meat to be a violent act?
You know what? I don't eat red meat, but I eat, you know, I have eaten fowl and I eat fish, right? I mean, I stopped eating fowl because I saw something in India that was so horrible I couldn't eat a piece of chicken for, you know, 10 years. This is like because we're in the situation we're in, the extreme measures you got to take sometimes to have the correct effect to be able to lift us up rather than pull us down. That's what he's talking about here. And that's the kind of fearlessness that really, you know, it's not just this alone is enough, aside from the cruelty, the way they raise livestock and everything, you know, aside from the, you know, it's really bad for your health, you know, eating, you know, oh, well, let's go eat free range shit, you know, okay, you know, I hear all that. But this is about fearlessness and extreme measures. And I can't believe that a young Tibetan monk, who's a reincarnation of this amazing being, is doing this. So that's why I was blown away by it.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's it is very insightful. When I hear it, though, I have some things come to mind. Like, for example, when he's talking about hunting, hunting, killing an animal in the wild is, if you're going to put a hierarchy or a gradient of compassion when it comes to slaughtering animals, killing an animal in the wild is the most compassionate way to get meat. The animals lived a completely free life. Usually, depending on the skill of the hunter, it doesn't even know what's happened. It's just gone. Okay.
This is, again, I'm going to take it back to, we are in certain times. Very few, I mean, there are definitely people who survive off of hunting, and he ain't talking about those people. He's not talking about the reality of hunting for food and eating that food and sustaining yourself. He's talking about maniacs, okay, who go out there for sport, okay?
You know, that's most hunters that I know, I'm not a hunter. I eat meat. I feel guilty about it if I think about it too much. I imagine that I should have a vegetarian diet. But most hunters that I know are far more in tune with the earth and with the food that they're eating than people who eat cheeseburgers. I've never met a man, like, you know, my dad hunts, Joe Rogan hunts, and these people, they have a direct contact with the thing that they're killing, and then they take the meat and they prepare it and cook it and give it to their families. And
okay, well, we're not, I'm trying to get to the big, we're not talking about people like that, for sure. People who are actually acting in the manner of how the American Indians acted.
Right.
Right. That is not who he's talking about. He's talking about ignorance.
Right.
He's talking about being fearless and doing things that would help create an antidote to the ignorance.
Right.
You know, which means curbing your own something at times. That's what he's talking about.
Yes. So, right. I know we're getting, I'm getting a little off track. You want to take the.
No, it's a good point. It's a good point. There are people who are doing it fully in the spirit of that the Native Americans held for the sanctity of the lives that they were taking and so on and so forth. And it was in the full cycle of life and, you know, I mean, you tell me that these people are in that kind of a place, and you know, I believe you.
Well, I'm not saying that they're reincarnated Tibetan monks, you know, but I think the deeper level here is that kind of numbness that overcomes a person and that allows for all kinds of behavior, you know, a kind of like, you know, for example, we walk, you know, you walk through a yard and you're just walking through grass. Like in Lemuria, you go walking through grass. And if you could zoom into that grass, I'm sure that you would see all kinds of bugs getting crushed. You know, there's a constant flow of death happening around us at all times. And you can only be aware of a certain amount of the violence that you're putting out into the world, you know, but eventually some people are completely unaware of anything that they do. It's numbness. Numbness seems to be the mother of violence.
That's exactly what he's addressing. I mean, you're hitting it right on the head. And that's really what's being talked about. And so at this retreat, we're talking about what's the first thing, you know, that's nothing can happen around this word compassion unless you start having some for yourself. You know, the stuff that we do, the judging and, you know, the self-worth issues and, you know, or the opposite, you know, of being completely caught in your role, ego, whatever it is, the first
leverage, right? The first transformation can only take place in reality. I mean, you know, you can do yoga and meditate and all that shit. None of it's going to matter unless you can actually have compassion for your bullshit. For you know, as I did this podcast with Alan Watts. I think I sent it to you because I said this thing is unbelievable. We found Alan Watts talking about Jung and Jung's relationship with that rascal part of him and how he had accepted that. And without doing that, you know, there's no way that he could help anybody. He couldn't treat anybody unless he had that first basic thing of accepting, you know, the shadow stuff, as you know, with Jung. But then the antidote was that he said, I just started to be kinder to the bullshit that was in my head.
Let me ask you.
Compassion.
When does compassion for the self become enabling laziness? Like, real world example. I want to go to the gym today. I just want to go jogging. It makes me feel good. But what if I don't go to the gym today? Am I supposed to be compassionate to the part of myself that didn't go and exercise? Or is there ever a time where there's usefulness in guilt, where there's some sort of merit to looking at your day and thinking, you know, I didn't really accomplish what I wanted to accomplish today. And that does not make me feel good. That makes me feel like I need to tighten up and try harder, and that creates this guilty feeling. Is there a place for guilt in the spiritual path, in this practice?
No, not guilt. No, that's just mind. It has nothing. It's guilt is no different than I got to take a shit. It's just another thought or emotion. It means absolutely nothing. And the point is,
that's cool.
The compassion isn't to I fucked my day up or not. The compassion is, wow, that's cool. I'm still thinking that it matters if I went to the gym or not. That's cool. Or, you know, I want to kill that guy. I have somebody I really am angry at, by the way. And I'm going to admit it on your show. There's a lady. I have a dog. My wife brought the dog back from India, from my guru's ashram in the foothills of the Himalayas. Okay? Kenchi. And Kenchi is the name of the dog. She saved it on the streets. It was a street dog puppy, 3 weeks old. So she got it back. She figured must be a good reason why this dog's coming back. Anyhow, but the dog has in its genes, it likes to go around anywhere. So we let it out and she goes around. And there's one neighbor across the woods insists on calling the cops. And they're saying, okay, if we get 5 tickets, we can take the dog and we're going to kill it. You lived in this place, you know. Boy, the South is harsh. 12 years a slave freaked me out, by the way. Anyhow, so this woman, I have really, really terrible, terrible thoughts and emotions about this woman that I cannot do anything about despite my 45 years of you know, working on this. See, that's real. You know, I don't really have that much guilt about it. I'm just like, wow, I got to turn this around or my dog won't be able to go out. How do I turn it around? And it's got to turn around inside me first. And that's really what it's all about.
Right. And that's compassion for the self.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you can't do that, then...
Okay. You're okay. You're just another human, you know, screw up. No problem.
But it's the impatience that comes, you know, it's this... You know, all those feelings are you know, guilt, anger, a sense of, you know, not working hard enough or accomplishing enough or all these things. They have some real serious emotional undertones that go along with them. They're heavy. It's a heavy place to be. And you just want it to stop. You know, when I'm feeling those things, when I'm feeling any kind of the negative emotions, you know, Jack Kornfield says, bow to them as they come to you.
Yep,
and,
exactly.
But I bow to them and, you know, it's like shitting, like you said, it's like, I can bow, if I'm constipated, I can bow to the constipation, but it's not going to change the fact that I need to take a shit. You know what I mean? Like, it's like there's action too, right, Raghu? Like, when does bowing to these things become a form of passivism? When there needs to be direct action that should be taken, the warrior's way, all that stuff.
No, you're getting that one wrong. That bowing is not a passive act.
Mm.
Absolutely not. It's an act of, like, an act of prayer. It's an act of, it's intention to surrender.
Ah.
To the one inside yourself, as Ram Dass would say. It's that intention. And right. That can't happen. And none of this can, you know, this compassion thing, nothing can happen unless you do the first, very first thing. And you already know this. And, you know, not to sound pedantic, but we all have to get control over our minds. Or ain't nothing going to be affected, which is what you're saying. You know, you try and do this shit, but if you are not having intention, like we just talked about, in the act, as an act of, you know, connecting to the one. If you don't have, you know, you need that intention. But at the same time, you need to have some sitting, meditation, mindfulness practice. You know, the big buzzword now, mindfulness. But you do need, you know, something to get a hold on the monkey mind.
I want to talk to you about that, meditation, and getting a hold of the monkey mind. Do you think that sometimes I on walks, I'll be chanting Hare Krishna and I have, you know, very wonderful moments through that. Does that count as meditating or is meditating limited to just sitting still for some period of time?
It is absolutely sitting still minimally 10 minutes. At least every day in the same kind of place would be good too, you know, little corner where that's all you do.
So walking around and chanting doesn't count, or being in your car and watching your breath or any of that stuff, that's secondary to this moment of finding a place and sitting still for 10 minutes.
Absolutely. That doesn't mean, you know, going around chanting is another method. Okay, but it's too easy to get daydreaming, you know, either, you know, breathing in your car is good, like, you know, to just get to some place of equanimity, you know, before you're going to do something or whatever, you're going to meet somebody or there's any anxiety, that's a great practice. But, and so it's chanting, you know, just walking down the street, but none of it is the formal coming back to whatever in the case that, you know, that's practice we've been doing for a long time is, and we've talked about it before, you know, insight meditation or vipassana, where you're just using your natural breath, focusing on the feeling of either your rising and falling stomach, or the feeling as the breath goes in the nostrils and out without any effort. And then every time you realize you're lost, you come back. And as Sharon just said earlier today, this morning, that is the great beauty. Because you can start again. Once you realize you're lost, you can start again. Mm. And you just keep doing that. And nothing stays the same. And that's the insight you get when you get into the more deeper parts of this of this practice. So, yeah, that is not replaceable.
So that is interestingly, that reminds me, that seems to be a microcosm of the entire spiritual practice, which is that it involves getting lost. It involves not just finding yourself again, but getting lost seems to be as much a part of this process as not being lost. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's the nature of us humans, and that's the good, you know, that's a good thing in terms of self-compassion, compassion for your bullshit. You know, that's definitely a good mantra. It's okay. I'm just human.
Hmm.
You know, I think that's a great mantra. I don't know whatever one of these teachers said that. It's okay. I'm human.
It's okay, I'm human. What a cool mantra. I've never heard that before.
Yeah, I think that's great.
By the way,
there's some people at this retreat. I said, how did you get here? This is a young guy from Australia, right? Duncan. I listened to Duncan.
That's great. Hey.
And then he comes up to take a picture of Ram Dass, and he met somebody else, a young girl, right? And she said, we just met because we both came here because we heard about it on Duncan.
Oh, that's so cool. Wow. So,
you're like the Pied Piper for Ram Dass or something.
Yeah, I'm the Pied Piper. It's true. I mean, because I talk about him all the time, and I talk about you guys all the time because you guys have had such an impact on me. And these conversations that we're recording, what's so cool is every once in a while you'll just call me. You always call me at exactly the right time. And you always accidentally bring up something that I've been wondering about or stuck on. And these conversations are so rejuvenating to me because that's what you guys do is you remind me again and again and again that it is about just finding yourself in the moment, just going back to finding yourself in the moment. And also this, it's nice to be reminded that I need to be meditating again because I stopped. I always stop, Raghu. I'll get it down, man. I'll have
you're
it twice.
And you're going to hell. And you just, you should start watching Jimmy Swaggart so he can knock the evil out of you.
Do you think I should start whipping my own back with my belt?
Yeah, that's good. That's a good one.
That's what Ram Dass recommends, right? Didn't Maharaji have everyone sit and whip themselves with their own belts in the morning?
Yeah, in Riyadh.
Now, I wanted to ask you if you could... So walk me through what you do in the morning when you meditate. How does it work for you when you get up? Do you mind? Like, you wake up, and then what happens?
My wife wants to have a chat with me, and then I tell her, you know what? I'm really not good at talking for about, another 90 minutes. That's what happens. And she's listening to this now, I bet, whenever this is going to air. So, hi, sweetie.
Hi, Saraswati.
Listen, it's exactly what I said just now. I do that practice. I use the natural breath, the practice of Vipassana. You can go online. Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, put them up on your thing. Let people go, and they give beautiful they have all kinds of different CDs, DVDs, and all books.
Sure, I listen. I'm listening. I listen to them all the time.
But
I'm curious about you. I'm curious about you wake up.
That's what I'm doing.
Do you have coffee first?
No.
So you wake up, you go to your puja table.
Exactly.
And you burn incense.
No.
No incense.
No, it's going to bother me. Kind of billowing incense that's been made in India with toxic materials. No.
No candles.
Nothing. No. Zero.
So you and do you sit in a chair or a cushion?
On the cushion.
And you sit in a cushion, and then you just...
By the way.
What's that?
Who would be interested in this?
Well, I'm interested. You've already... Because, I mean, I don't know if there's a right way to do it, but I'll tell you, if I am meditating, here's what I do. Wake up, look at my phone, check my messages, go to Reddit, go to CNN.com. If I really want to get bummed out, I'll go to the Drudge Report. Then I wake up, I go into my kitchen, pour some coffee... I'll burn incense, light some candles, make a big show of the thing. I have a bell. I'll ring the bell. I don't even know why I ring it. Then I sit down.
Oh, that's fantastic. Could you send me your list? I like your list way better. I'm going to start doing it the way you do it, and I'll probably get enlightened, And that brings up another thing. Nobody should think anybody has... the reality is we do have to get a hold of our minds, and that is seemingly the simplest way is just follow your breath, and whenever you're lost, come back to it and sit with a straight back as possible and be comfy and try and do at least 10 and then get to 20. And that's it. And there will be a reinstatement of some of the sanity that... you've lost this lifetime.
Right, and it's shocking. And that's the other thing that happens when I do meditate, and then at the end of the period, I will suddenly feel so much better. It reminds me of when I go running. And there's something in that that's so simultaneously wonderful, yet the mind does not like the simplicity of it. It's almost as though the mind doesn't want it to be that easy, that you could just sit down and then suddenly feel.
Just a minute now. It's not easy. The hardest thing I ever did was one of these Vipassana 10-day courses. It would remain the hardest thing.
That is nuts. When I hear about those 10-day Vipassana courses, I just can't. Just even thinking about it right now gives me a headache and anxiety attack.
Yeah, fear. And you should have it, because sitting and facing yourself hour after hour after hour, especially in your case, could be a frightening possibility.
Thanks.
You know what? You walk out of there. First of all, you can meditate for the rest. You'll know how to meditate for the rest of your life. That's worth something.
Yes.
Really do it. And second of all, you'll have gone through some definitive catharsis of your inner being. So for sure, for sure. But, you know, we don't have to get that heavy about it. Really, if you just sit down and just start the process of watching, you know, just watching, letting the thoughts go, you know, not catching on to everything. That's what's really going on. That's where the compassion comes in. Whenever you realize you're sticking or you're doing what Sharon called today, doing the add-ons. You know what the add-ons are?
No.
Geez, it's really humid in here. I'm kind of feeling humid, sticky. I wonder if I'm going to start sweating, but I got to go out. So I wonder if the shirt I'm wearing is the right one. Okay, that's the ad. You're lost. There's an actual Pali term for it. I don't know the Pali word, but it means proliferation. Okay. So until you can get a grip on that, and that's what Sharon is teaching. And by the way, it's upstreaming as we speak. If you go to, can I give this little?
Yeah, please. But, you know, the problem is if you give it, it won't. This comes out in a week.
Yeah, because you're not. Can't you just put this out right away?
But
you know what?
Then it's going to mess up my plan, which is to make it the 108th episode. But you know what I will do? Is if you, when we get done with this podcast, I'll tweet live stream Ram Dass retreat.
You know what? Don't even worry. You can do that. But the reality is this: if you go to ramdass.org, you'll see live spring retreat stream. You just hit on that, and it's going to be cached, so you'll be able to watch it anytime.
That's so cool that you guys do that.
Yeah, no, it is. I mean, it's our mission statement. It's to share. It's just what, you know, it's what Ram Dass was about when he came back from India. And his guru said, you know, the first time he said, whatever you do, don't talk about me. That's all he did. He didn't do anything more than that.
That's the way you get your message out, is you tell hippies not to talk about you.
Yeah. Hey, can I read one more thing?
Please.
To me, this is a quote from a book by a man named Joseph Goldstein, who is Sharon's partner at the IMS, which is Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts, who just wrote a book called Mindfulness, which is just this. It's a very, very thick book that is absolutely incredible. It's not like not bedtime reading. It's really something to work with, kind of a deal.
Okay.
But he had one of the best explanations and definitions of compassion. And it really references everything you and I have been talking about when you're talking about what is that thing can just leverage out of us out of the, you know, ignorant part of ourselves that's causing so much pain, right?
Yes.
And we talk about compassion. Compassion is the very act of emptiness of self. This is compassion, not as a stance of the ego, or even as a particular practice, but as the spontaneous expression of a heart and mind free of self-reference.
Wow.
That's the only thing that's going to, it's going to save not only ourselves, but everybody, everybody, you know, that's too dramatic.
No, it's beautiful. I've had these experiences. I know what he's talking about. I've had it the first time I felt that I was on LSD. I was on this wonderful liquid LSD that someone had at this party. I've never had LSD like this since. It was amazing. It was just this. Someone must have just made it a day before or something. It was just perfect.
Fresh and organic, eh?
What's that?
Fresh and organic.
Fresh and organic, and just, you know, I don't know if you ever come into contact with well-made, or I don't know anything about LSD manufacture, but if you come into contact with the real thing, it is really like getting to just kiss Jesus on the lips. And I remember sitting, I was with this girl, we were listening to, I think we were listening to Beethoven. She had a record and she was playing it, and I was listening to the musical notes, and then I started thinking about my thoughts. And I'm thinking, this is mindfulness practice before I ever came in contact with it, really. I'm just thinking like, well, my thoughts are there. And then I started thinking, well, where are my thoughts coming from? Like, what's producing the thoughts? And I was able to follow the thoughts all the way back. And something happened in that moment where I just was gone. Like, I just, something happened, and it was just this feeling of expansiveness. And that's all. Just this sense of, you know, it reminds me of what Ram Dass says when he says, dying is like taking off a shoe that's too tight. You know, it was that feeling. So I know exactly that idea of being free from self-reference.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, that's why psychedelics, you know, they were important to us too. You know, those of us that went to India at that time and followed, you know, his lead. We had a basic understanding experientially of what was being talked about. You know, so when we actually went there and met that thing, it was like meeting a giant, I don't know what to call him, you know, that explains it in a way that it's not the normal terms of, you know, Indian enlightened or realized, you know, a giant love computer that knew exactly the right thing for everybody to get free at every second, and was omniscient, knowing past, present, and future of every being. You know, so, you know, whatever that, that was one of my first impressions of him when I was there.
Wow.
So to have a sense of that, which you did through that acid trip, is highly, you know, it's pretty important. And now I'm not, most people go out, take acid and go to electronica concerts, right?
Sure.
So, you know, that's a different, that's just the same kind of thing we talked about at the very beginning. It is what, you know, how you relate with, you know, if it's hunting and you're relating with it in a way that you are participating in the cycle of life and you are completely connected, that's way different from someone who's, you know, got a submachine gun out there, you know, yeah, you know, hunting animals, okay? That's two completely different things,
right,
in the same way, so is this.
And it's, and that, I see what you're saying now. It's this, okay, this reminds me of something that I was thinking, because I've been listening to a lot of Jack Kornfield lately and thinking about a lot of what he's talking about. The thought, when you think about reality, nature, life, everything around us and us, you can either have an experience of directly connecting with it, or you can have an experience of trying to not connect with it, trying to avoid connecting with what's happening. And if you get caught up in your thoughts, thoughts are this kind of like phantasmal representation of life. They're ghosts, they're clouds. And you get caught up in those clouds, then you're not having a direct interface with life. And it seems like the compassion that you are talking about is having once you really start connecting to life, then how would you be violent? Or how could you be in that, if you were really in that state of interfacing with those animals hanging there, watching?
Yeah, that's nothing to do with compassion. When you do start to evolve, you just can't do those kinds of things because it's just so unconscious and ignorant. You can't do it. You can't be slaughtering, you know, animals. You can't do it. you know, and that's a whole other level. No, the level, I mean, what we're talking about with compassion is a way to leverage the complete self-referential nature that we have. I, me, mine, all day long. Attached to and stuck to every thought as if it's real. That's what the way to leverage that is. The first thing you got to do is stop hating yourself for having those thoughts or right. feeling less than or feeling more than, you know. And so that's what we're talking about is having, you know, it's Ram Dass calls, I love my thoughts to death.
It seems so. I love what you're saying, but it's the, I'm just going to let my mind speak for a second because my mind, when it contemplates the idea of spending any amount of time, either like loving either my narcissism or embracing what's happening, the way I'm living and the way I'm acting for better or for worse, when I'm being kind or when I'm being cruel, when it considers the idea of letting myself relax into it, even for a second, it is like, that's a monstrous act.
I don't understand. Relax into what?
Into this.
Let's say you're cruel. You've been cruel to somebody.
Let's say.
What happened?
I'm saying, well, okay, for example, just a simple, I can't enjoy, when I'm not meditating, which I'm not doing right now, it's very hard for me to enjoy anything. Everything that I do is laced with some bit of guilt. So, and especially things that aren't related to working or producing something, working on a podcast or working on stand-up or writing or exercising. So, for example, if I'm, I don't know, playing a video game, let's say. Let's say I sit down and decide to play a video game. I can't do it. If I do it for more than a few minutes, I'm just filled with such a sense of self-loathing. And I look at what I'm doing and I just think, you can't do this anymore. You're 39, man. You can't play video games. This is fucked up. You are wasting time. You're wasting time. And so then I'll play that. That never has stopped me from playing a video game. But I'll just play it with this feeling of guilt. Or let's say I'm eating marijuana, for example. Let's say I wake up in the morning and I'm like, you know what? I'm going to eat some marijuana and go right at a cafe. So I'll eat marijuana. Everything becomes beautiful. I'll sit and write at the cafe, but there's always an undercurrent, this dark black river of guilt running through everything. So
okay, I got it. Okay, the doctor has a solution.
Great.
Keep eating that marijuana every day, twice a day, and keep doing it and play the video game while you're doing it. It's probably more, you know, more fun.
Yes.
Because nothing's going to happen to you. You don't get anything out of it. You're going to continue to do that till you either don't get anything out of it or it's distracting, you know, some other priority, right?
Yes.
But so nothing's going to change. You are going to keep doing this shit until it just sort of, you know, it evolves into something that, because nothing stays the same. You're not going to be doing this forever.
Right.
Either, you know, I mean, whatever it might be. So what the only thing you can deal with is the guilt, is to love that, is to give it space, is to just witness it from a deeper place that, you know, you're human. There's your mantra. It's okay. I'm only human.
God, that is so wild, man. That is so, what you're saying is blasphemy to so many people. So many people would hear that and they would think, no, you don't embrace that. You don't embrace that. You stop, clench up, tighten your muscles, go jump in some mud or, you know, find some uncomfortable activity to spend your time doing until you feel better about yourself.
No, you do. That might be the next thing you do because it's proliferation. It goes from guilt to, you know, trying to hammer yourself to death, thinking, you know, whatever it may be. It goes from one emotion to another.
Yes.
So each time you just, it's like when you're meditating you realize you're lost in thought and you're not feeling the breath going in and out of your nostrils as you breathe normally, you know, and lost in thought. So instead of going, oh my fucker, I've lost it again, you go, wow, great, okay, I'll start again. So you keep starting again by, okay, I'm, you know, I feel guilty about this and, you know, I'm a lazy fuck. And, you know, I'd rather do this than meditate or whatever. And I just want to have fun. You know, it's okay. It's okay. And you stop that self-referential. We need to. You think, I mean, I'm doing this all the time myself. But that is our methodology.
It's so cool, man. And it's so intense because it is not passive. To really do that, that is not a passive thing. To really just let yourself be in the thing. And while you're in it, love it, instead of ripping yourself to shreds over whatever the dissatisfying thing or the thing that's less than the way you think you should be that you're doing. It's just, it really is. I think it's a revolutionary take on it. You know, you don't hear that a lot of the time. So many models of the way to be are based on, in, you know, symbolically whipping yourself with some kind of belt. Spare the rod, spoil the child. Hello? So we got... one second. So we got cut off for a second there. Hold on one second. And when we were cut off, where we left it was... we got cut off right when I said, it seems like so many systems teach that you should be hurting if you want to grow. Spare the rod, spoil the child.
What system? Where is that system?
It's the system. It's the system of public education. It's the system military, okay. Industrial complex, prisons. It's the system of work. It's the system of capitalism. It's the idea that if you want good things, you suffer now. Suffer in the moment so in some future point you can feel great. But right now, if you're not feeling bad, you're not doing something right.
Okay, we grew up with the worst horror in this culture. Yes, it's true. And our parents and whatever they did and past car. I mean, we have a lot of tsuris, as they say.
Yes.
You know what tsuris are. Right?
Say that again, please. You faded out.
We have a lot of tsuris.
Yes.
A lot of tsuris problems.
Yes.
And so what? We just got it. Just stop looking at the, you know, this big ugly world that has created the monsters that we call us in terms of being completely lost and ignorant, and say, okay, we have some tools now and we're going to start to use these tools because we don't want to be so screwed up anymore. That's, you know, you have to have some motivating force for wanting to change, whatever it is. It could be through suffering or it could be just through waking up on acid, seeing the connectivity of everything and knowing that that is possible. So we'll go back to the tool, the two tools, compassion for, you know, all of these feelings and self-referential bullshit that comes up every second, and start loving it to death is the best way you could say it. I mean, compassion or, you know, we're only human. We really are only human. We're doing the best we can, so we're only human. So you pick yourself up. I mean, if you walk home today, you know, go home today from this podcast and go, okay, I've been feeling shitty because I haven't meditated and somehow something's waking me up and I think I'm going to start again. So you'll start again. Great. That's the beauty of the human thing. We can start again because we got consciousness.
Oh, God. I'm so lucky. I really must be one of the luckiest people ever that I get to have these conversations with you. I feel so grateful. It really is cool, man. Every time. It's like a tuning fork. This is why you need a spiritual community, I think. This is the reason there needs to be a sangha. This is why people need, you know, because I, you know, sometimes I'll some of my friends, they don't have a Raghu Marcus or a Ram Dass, and they get, you know, they don't have someone to say, listen, love yourself and just meditate some more. You'll be fine. They don't even have that. So I think it's so important what you guys are doing. And I, but, you know, I don't mean to like.
It's a little complex, of course. So I don't want to dumb it down too much. There are other, I mean, certainly, you know, look at someone like yourself. You delve into it. You've gone to retreats, right?
Yes.
Engaged with people like Jack Kornfield.
Yes.
Right? Who have, you know, so much to offer. Practical stuff, not esoteric stuff. You don't need, you know, this guy, Joseph Goldstein, who's been studying and, you know, every year he goes on, you know, three-month retreats. I mean, he's really practicing what he's preaching and has really is an amazing soul. That that podcast will be out on Mind Rolling Podcast, folks, in a couple of weeks. But he said to me, you know what? I'm not a Buddhist. This guy has been practicing Buddhism for 50 years or something, 45 years, 40 years.
Yeah.
He said, I'm not a Buddhist. It's not about a Buddhist. It's about self-awareness. That's what it's about. It's about being able to do something decent for your neighbor or anybody you see every day, that you're having, you know, a generous exchange rather than what am I going to do? Oh, God, this, that, you know, whatever, all the bullshit that goes through our minds. So it's worth getting control of that mind, and it's worth practicing compassion.
Well, because it creates revolutionary changes in your life. And I'll give you an example, and this is directly from the stuff that I've learned from going to the retreats and talking to you and Ram Dass and Jack Kornfield, which is that I was having a – speaking of neighbors – I was in a cold war with my neighbor, and we were in a cold war over, I don't know, the garbage cans, and I don't know, just we were, it just was a power struggle thing, and my ego would flare up, and I didn't want to do anything that she wanted me to do, because I felt, I didn't like the way she was asking me. It's just all bullshit ego stuff, and, you know, so I was in this dumb war, and I used to live my whole life like that, man. My life used to be vengeance was normal. Like if I could win, that's all that mattered. Or if I could be on, you know, even I'm not saying I was like a rampaging jerk, but definitely was into winning a war like that. I wanted to be the one who got apologized to. I wanted to be the one on top. But I remember just this, you know, this from assimilating some of this stuff that you guys were saying and going into a mindful state and watching and thinking, okay, wait, that's your ego that wants to tell her that you think she's a fucking asshole and that if she has a problem, talk to the landlord, not me. Blah. And so she got sick. And I was thinking about all this stuff and this was like she was sick in the midst of us having real serious, like not serious, but we're just not getting along. And then I'm like, you know what? I'm going to get her some soup. I'm going to bring her some soup. I'm going to bring her some miso soup because that helps when you're sick. And I brought it to her and I remember how happy she got and we looked at each other and suddenly this entire thing that would have been going on even to this very day, it transformed. And now when I see her, we smile and talk and I'm living in a little tiny little utopian place here that used to be a war zone. And that's because of what you guys are putting out there. And that's how revolutionary this stuff can be. And because it really is important to have harmony with your neighbor. It's a terrible feeling to know that. And so I know what you're feeling with your neighbor. It's a real mind fuck. It's a real drain.
And I'm not kidding about that. I'm having a real problem myself with it. And you're absolutely right. It's revolutionary. And what this thing I read of the Karmapa earlier, you know, fearlessness. It takes real fearlessness to even approach changing who you've been, you know. And so that's definitely part of the whole recipe for just being able to break through of this complete self-referential life that we lead. So that's beautiful, though. And that's really sweet.
Well, it's sweet, and it leads to I don't know what the word for it is, but it's ecstasy. It's a kind of great feeling. The more you do these things, the more the mind, all the things the mind tells you to stay. It's like the mind looks at a hot tub and says, oh, that's freezing water. Do not go into that hot tub. And then you begin to think like, God, I'm going to avoid these actions of compassion and love at all cost. That's the fear. And then the moment it happens, wow, this feels better than anything I've ever felt. And then you start thinking like, well, is this then if I keep doing this, then what universe am I going to be living in? Mm-hmm. It's almost the opposite of an apocalypse. You know, it's like a Nirvana lips or something.
Nirvana lips. Yes.
Nirvana lips. That's I've got to save that. I've got to call it. Yeah, that's got to be someone's nickname.
And by the way, Nirvana just got inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
And they deserve it.
And they deserve it.
Because they were so happy. Didn't they used to play at the Ram Dass retreats?
Oh, yes. Every year, yes, Kurt would reimagine his body. And
reimagine his body.
It's fun. This is fun. I always love hanging out with you.
Well, I wonder what would have happened. That's funny to think. You know what? What if Kurt Cobain had gone to a Ram Dass retreat? Would we not have had Nirvana? What would have happened? Would you guys have eliminated a wonderful band by transforming Kurt Cobain's angst into something beautiful and ecstatic?
You want to hear something crazy?
Yes.
Kurt Cobain's manager from when Nirvana is at the retreat happens to be a very close old friend. His name is Danny Goldberg, and he is here at the retreat. Can you believe we're talking about that?
That's wild. Funny. Wow, that's cool. That is really cool. Those retreats are great, man. I am not going to keep you away from the retreat any longer. We've done an hour. Thank you for your the time that you've given us, and please. I know everyone is going to want to know how to find that stream. So that's at ramdass.org. You guys are going to have this if people want to go to the retreat, at least sort of go to the retreat. Listen to the lectures at the retreat. They can go there, right?
Watch is not listen. You know, you actually – it's a video.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Oh, that's great. Guys, you should definitely go and do this. I'm going to –
It's not action, but –
I'm going to do it. And it's a good, it's a far, far away, but in December, I'm definitely coming to that retreat. So
and some of your audience, you know, your podcast audience is at this retreat. How crazy is that?
Well, hopefully they're listening to this conversation. Hi, you guys. I love you. I wish I was there with you. I'm going to be there in December though. So come back again in December. Cause I remember the last retreat I met people from the podcast, and it's really cool hanging out on the beach at night after the retreat, and everyone's just
naked.
Yeah. Everyone's naked, making love, shooting heroin. Just kidding. Everyone's
heroin. It was nice with the, all right. I love talking to you today.
I love you, Raghu. You are such a wonderful person. Thank you for this. And I'll put all the links to the Ram Dass website and Mind Rolling Podcast, which all of you should be listening to that podcast. And any other links that you send me, links, blah, blah, blah. Thank you, Raghu. Please tell everyone hello and tell Ram Dass I love him, please.
Will do. All love to you.
Okay.
All love.
All love. Bye, Raghu. See ya. Aloha. Thanks for listening, everybody. That was Raghu Marcus. Be sure to listen to Mind Rolling Podcast, located at mindrollingpodcast.com, and go to squarespace.com. Sign up for a membership. Put my name in. Duncan, you'll get 10% off. Thanks for listening, everybody, and give us a nice rating on iTunes, won't you? See you around. Bye-bye.